hopefully we'll have more time for discussion, and I want to tell you some of the things that I'm proposing to try to help out, and maybe we can all take a look at where we might take what we get here back to where we are and say, what can we do in those situations, or come up with something. And as I said the other day, the topic, prisons, ex-offenders, and rehabilitation, is a bit misleading in that really I don't know very much about prisons and very little about rehabilitation, and mostly what I know about is ex-offenders, and I know something about that, but I've got a lot to learn. And as I told people yesterday, I have nothing to do with the correction system. I'm really a trained geologist, and what I'm going to tell you about is my own ignorance and my efforts to help ex-offenders. But I think it would be helpful to begin with to outline the problems as I see it. And as I've looked back through the years in which I've grown up and read the newspapers, the almost every year that I've seen reports that come out of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, on crime rates across the country, almost every year that I can remember, the crime rate has gone up 10-15% as long as I can remember, and that's 20 or 25 years ago. So that it's a frightening thing when you consider the crime rate has now gone up a total of 300 or some percent over this period of time, and it's still going up. And I think that we need, as Christians, to start doing something about it, and that the prison system just isn't working, and it's getting worse. And I outlined the fact that in California, there was a period of time in which the prison population was going down because they were trying an early release program to try to get these people back into society. But because of those early releases, there was a rather dramatic increase in crime in California and some rather spectacular murders and a lot of publicity. And the public just would not stand for this. And there was an immediate demand for a hard line, put these people back in prison and keep them there. And so as a result, San Quentin, which they had intended to phase out, is now filling back up, and I suspect it's full again. And I pointed out that within my own county where I live, the county jail, I don't know exactly what it's designed for. I suggested something like 100 inmates, but there is over 400 people in prison right now, and they're just jam-packed. They just don't have places to put these people. The other significant fact for me as a taxpayer in California is that I think that the average cost of processing somebody who commits a crime through the total legal system and getting him into prison and then warehousing him for 1 year, it costs the public $20,000 on the average for each inmate. And that is a significant cost. It would be much better, as far as I'm concerned, if they were out earning something and paying taxes rather than me taking care of them. The other thing that bothers me is that the prisons are supposed to be places where you send them to rehabilitate them so that when they come out, they are then ready to re-enter society. And depending on whose figures you use, the recidivism rate, and the word recidivism is something that I learned when I started in this, is a word that means the rate at which people return to prison when they are released. And usually within 1 year or within 5 years, 60-85% of those that are released are right back in prison, so that the prison door is like a revolving door. You go in and out. Some of these people have been in and out 4 or 5 times. So the prison system as a rehabilitation effort is not working. I need at the same time to say that there is a need for prisons, because when you get people who have a violent reaction to society for one reason or another, society has to be protected, and there are some people who need to be put away so that we are safe. There are some people who have, for medical reasons, are just unsafe on the streets, and you need to put these dangerous people behind bars. at the same time, the costs of putting these people away and the increasing rate at which we're putting them away is such that our taxes have to go to building new prisons, warehousing and feeding these people. And it costs so much money to do that that, to my knowledge, the budget for the correction system in California has to spend 95% of their budget in just warehousing these people, and they only have 5% left over to do any kind of corrections work or any kind of rehabilitation is what I mean to say. So that with 5% of the budget, you're not going to have any but a token effect on rehabilitating. I know I'm repeating much what I said the other day, but I think it probably should go on the tape. The other thing is that I think we all need to realize how an ex-offender feels and what he's up against when he comes out of prison. And prison is just hell. And the people who are in there are counting the days until they can get released. They want to get out. They want to go straight if they just have a chance. And I think we all need to understand what a ex-offender is up against when he does come out. It used to be he was given just $50 and a suit of clothes, and then said, okay, you get started now and make an effort to put your life in order. The state of California realized that finally that this is too small, and I think they've now increased that to $250 and a suit of clothes. Many of these people have been in prisons a good part of their life. By this time, their families, many of them have disowned them. They have no place to go to when they get out, and so they come back to the city where they originated from, many of them. What can you do with $250? You got to find a place to stay. Many landlords demand a full month's rent when you come to find a place to stay, and that'll take practically the whole chunk perhaps out of their $250. What they've got left over, they've got to perhaps buy more clothes with in order to look presentable. They've got to buy their food. They've got to get transportation, some way to get to a job and to go from place to place to say, will you hire me? Probably will have to be by bus, which isn't always convenient to go where they want to go, or taxi or something like that. At any rate, the first month to 3 months after they get out is a very critical period because they've got to establish themselves. And one of the real problems is a cultural shock. I've talked to some of my colleagues who have gone on Fulbright programs to foreign countries to teach or to do research, and some of them, for example, have gone to Japan or some foreign country, and they say they have a real culture shock coming back from that kind of environment to the United States, readjusting their whole thinking. And you can imagine, or perhaps you can imagine, what kind of a cultural shock these people have, having been out of society behind walls for 10, 15 years and then coming back and having the freedom to get on a bus and go someplace free. It's a real cultural shock for them. At any rate, the ex-offender, when he comes out, he has felt that, and sometimes realistically, that he realizes that he did commit a crime against society, that he deserved to go to prison. But when he completes his term, he feels that, okay, I've paid my debt to society. I want to go straight. I'm ready to really make an effort. But the problem is he meets the straight society, who is many of them, and not all, of course, who are scared to death if somebody is next to them has been in prison. They don't know what attitude to take. There's almost a paranoia or a hysteria that, supposing that person is in school teaching my children or wherever it happens to be. And so There's also, I mentioned, a somewhat superior attitude to, on the straight society, each one of us tending to feel, well, I'm better than you, I didn't go to prison, and I've never done anything wrong. You got just exactly what you deserved, an approach that says, well, we just sort of, in our pride, say that we would never done anything like that. And I reminded people yesterday that, at least for myself, as I look back through my life, there's been a few things which I've done, which if I had been caught, and if somebody had taken effort to prosecute me, I would have gone to prison. And so I have to realize that I'm not perfect, that I'm a sinner, and that just by the grace of God, I'm here now free and have not been in prison, but somebody who has perhaps have gone in just because they were poor and they couldn't afford a lawyer, they've gone into prison. The other thing is that I mentioned that was brought home forcibly to me one day is that somebody told me that I would really was just 9 meals away from a crime. And as I thought about how hungry I get after one day without any food, by 3 days I would be so hungry I'd be ready to steal some bread. And as I thought about these ex-offenders spending their last dime before the month runs out and they haven't got a job yet, how easy it would be to, if they hadn't had any encouragement and help for somebody, a friend of theirs, to say, I know where we can get some quick money, let's go get it. And as I say, that first month, it's so critical. They may have all the desires in the world to go straight and to make an effort, but if nobody is there to help to give them that encouragement and that little extra boost, they say, well, I've done all I can. Society is closing the doors. I filled out the job application form, and there was that line that said, have you ever been convicted for a crime? And I had to fill it in honestly that I was, but the manager said, I'm sorry, we can't use you. And so many doors are closed that they feel like they paid their debt to society, but people say, no, we don't want you. And so they go back to crime, and the only place they know where they can get a full meal every day is back in prison. Okay. Let me just move on then very quickly and tell you about the organization that I have been working with in the last 3 years, and to review with you the background as to how this organization got started. It's called Jove 2. There is a Jove 1 that's in San Diego. The man that I'm working with is Paul Jones. He's a black. He spent 17 years in prisons. I think he went in primarily for armed robbery, in and out. He was in San Quentin at the time that I'm going to tell you about, and he came out of his prison cell to go out to the exercise yard to get some exercise, and as he walked out into the open area there, he suddenly noticed that everything was ominously silent, and he noticed that half the inmates were down at one end of the field and the other half was down at the other. And I've forgotten the mix that was there, but let's just say at one end was the white and the other end was the blacks and the Chicanos, whatever that turned out to be. And he saw all the guards around the walls. The warden was looking over, walking around with the photographer taking pictures. And he described it as a Mexican standoff. It was a riot in procession. And he said it went on for about an hour like that, and suddenly the warden said everybody back to their cells, and the guards opened fire, and he said he was lucky to get back into his cell and to survive. And he said, as far as he knows, that none of this ever got out to the press. Nobody ever knew that this particular riot happened, and this is often the case that many things go on in prisons that never get out to the press. He had spent such a hellish time in prison constantly trying to protect his own back from being stabbed or something, and you're always on your guard from things that will happen, that this particular riot and situation finally just was the last straw as far as his own life was concerned. And he decided that if he ever got out of prison, that he would resolve to make sure that nobody, as to the best of his ability, would ever go back to prison. It was just so bad. At any rate, when he got out, he heard about Project Job 1 in San Diego and wanted to establish one like it in Pasadena. And Jove is a, the letters J-O-V-E, is the capital letters there stand for the first letters of what they're trying to do. J is job location, try to find a job for an ex-offender when he comes out. O is for on-the-job training. If the man doesn't have any skills, they try to place him in a place where he can be trained to have some skills to do the work. The V is for vocational training. They try to get scholarships to put an ex-offender through a school, some sort of a vocational training, so that they can actually earn a living. And the E is for education. They're trying to spend a great deal of their effort educating the straight society as to the many myths that occur as to how straight society views an ex-offender, and there are all kinds of myths. I would dearly love to get this man up here and let him talk to people in Holden Village and outline all the different kinds of myths that there are about ex-offenders in the prison system. At any rate, one of the problems that he outlined to me is that he was in prison all the time being trained by their rehabilitation program to do a certain job. When he got out of prison, that job didn't exist, and he had no skills. And this is one of the problems, is that the rehabilitation programs in many of the jails are so out of date that what we're trying to rehabilitate them for, when they get out, there's no jobs for them. And so there again, they're up against the wall. Okay, let me just say that what they do when an ex-offender comes to their office is that they sit down and make a confidential record of the man's background, his particular skills. If they watch the way he sits in a chair, whether he slouches down, what his dress is, and they very carefully point out to him that what you're doing, if you're going into an office with an interview, that manager looking at you is not going to hire you at all. You don't have any appearance of confidence, any apparent good presentation that you would make to the public. And so they sit down and they'll work with this man and teach him how to interview for a job so that he really has a chance when he walks in the office. So they then, on the basis of the skills that they write down for this man, then Joe, too, is constantly going out talking to employees, looking for job opportunities, and when they find a man with a particular skill, they try to place him on a job that fits his particular needs and save him the effort of hunting around all over to try to find where he might fit in. So they are then getting him to a job as quickly as they can. And then once they get him to the job and hired, they don't just drop him right at that point, but they, assuming that the funds are available, the counselor that works with him, who is also an ex-offender, will go back to the employee and check in with him once a month, twice a month, whatever the case deserves, and say, how is Joe getting along? Is he working out well? What is his problems? And the employee says, well, he's having this and this kind of problem, and we're not sure we're going to keep him or not. And so the counselor then goes to the ex-offender and says, look, Joe, you're really blowing it right here. You've got to shape up or they're going to release you. And what is your problems? And why are you doing this? And so by this interaction, they're able to give this man encouragement and point out his problems, and they talk the same language. The employee might come up to him and talk to him and tell him to do something. And the ex-offender may not understand at all what the guy is saying, but he's scared to death to reveal his ignorance, and so he'll lie about it in order to get by for fear that he's going to lose his job, and as a consequence, he gets in worse trouble. The ex-offender talking to another ex-offender can tell when the man's bluffing and say, "Look, buddy, I've been in prison. You're not fooling me one bit." And he's able to see through things because his knowledge of how an ex-offender acts and behaves, and he's able to straighten the man out and get him working again. So because of this kind of follow-up and the effort in which ex-offenders are working with ex-offenders, in the 3 years that I've been working with them, I think they've now counseled over 1,000 ex-offenders in this program. They have been able to place, I think, over half of these in jobs which are well-paying, and even if they have not personally placed them, they have referred them to other agencies which have helped and gotten them. At any rate, the recidivism rate of the ex-offenders that have gone through Job 2 is something like 10 to 15% rather than 85%. And so, as a result of this kind of effort, people who normally would be back in prison after a year are now out going straight, and they're just disproving the myth that the prison door is revolving, that these people really are not happy unless they're back in prison. Now let's see where my notes are. One of the efforts of Paul Jones has been to try to get the community behind him. He joined the Chamber of Commerce in Pasadena to get to know the businessmen there so that they would get familiar with him. He went into the mayor's office and talked to the police chief, and as I said yesterday, it took almost a year before they overcame the suspicions of these people as what ex-offenders were. What are you doing bringing all these ex-offenders into this area? They've been coming in all the time, but they just didn't realize that the problems existed there. And it wasn't before a year that we got letters of endorsement from the chief of police and the mayor, and we've been trying to get all kinds of people who would say this is a great organization, please help them out. At the end of the first year, the newspapers reported a 22% drop in crime in Pasadena. As I said yesterday, the police department was delighted with this drop in crime. They thought that they had, and they may very well have had because of their increased efficiency, been the major effect in causing that drop in crime. But I can't help but think that perhaps the reason the drop in crime is the fact that Joe 2 was operating that year, and that those some 300 ex-offenders who came back to the Pasadena area, instead of going back to crime in order to survive, were getting help and going back to work, and they were not out busy ripping somebody off or doing something like that. In the second year of operation, I went with Paul Jones out to the Chino prison for women. Joe, too, makes a practice of going once a month to each of the 17 or 18 prisons in California to find out which of the inmates are going to be coming out within the next 6 months. And they start a pre-release counseling period so that they can start getting the information on these people so they can start lining up jobs for them before they ever get out. The ex-offenders at Chino, the women there, almost every month there is some organization coming in and say, "Gee, we'd like to help you." And they come in and they sit down and they talk to them and all propose all kinds of things. And then they disappear and they never see them again. And these do-gooder organizations who have great hopes of helping, they sound great, but they don't seem to continue. They're not really motivated. The ex-offenders that we went out there were wondering, is Project Joe just another like that? And so they're very much disillusioned, and they have been pleasantly surprised that Joe, too, comes back every month and that there's something waiting for them when they get out. I got permission to take some photographs in the prison area of some of the ex-offenders, and if I had taken a picture of this room right here and showed you the picture of those that I took in the prison, you would not be able to see any difference in the inmates that I've got, took pictures of, and your picture here, in terms of just be different faces, but they're just people. I talked to one, I guess it was a Filipino woman. As I was talking to her, she was wanting very desperately to get out, and she had a 3-year term. She had 2 more years to go. I don't know what her crime was, but she said, I'm ready to leave. Go right now. I've got a family and two children. I miss them dearly. What's the use of me staying here 2 more years? I mean, I know what I did was wrong. Why should I sit around? I want to go straight. It's just useless for me to sit here and not have an opportunity to make right. It's just a wasted part of my life. And as I talked to many of these people, it turned out that the people I was talking to were people who were poor. They didn't understand the language or something, didn't know how to go about to get a proper defense. I would guess that the kind of problem that she had, if she understood the language, she would have gotten a good lawyer, she wouldn't have been in prison. But it's just the poor and the people who don't know the system that end up there. Okay. One of the things that Joe, too, has attempted to create was to set up a halfway house in the YWCA in Pasadena. And they didn't want it to be a typical halfway house. They wanted to put them in an environment where they were actually working with some in a straight society so that there was an interaction. It seemed an ideal place in the YWCA where you've got the straight people coming in and out of the building, and there could be some interaction. They also wanted to put a counselor in there, an ex-offender, somebody who knew the community, who could help them go to get jobs and to work out the total program. With much effort, we finally convinced the YWCA to release an upper story floor area that they weren't using to do this, and the program was working pretty well for a time, but the board of directors for YWCA began to get upset with these ex-offenders running around, and eventually they stopped it. But it was working good while it was going. One of the things that Joe, too, has been doing is they've been setting up business seminars in which they invite the owners and the managers of some of the large stores and department stores and grocery stores, whatever, to come hear from an ex-offender's view of how to protect their own businesses from being robbed or whatever the situation might be, and telling it from how an ex-offender would look at their business. Now, the police often have their own program like this as to going through, but when you hear it from a man who is a professional robber telling you what he's looking for, then you believe it, I think, much better. I can give you an example of the 7-Eleven stores. I don't know, I know the 7-Eleven stores occur in California. I don't know how many other cities they have it. There was a period three years ago where in the Los Angeles area the 7-Eleven stores were being ripped off almost once a month or more often, and I think they had lost 5 or 6 managers from being shot. It was getting quite serious. And they finally invited Joe Tu in as an advisor. What would you do to prevent this sort of thing happening? And I don't know all the things that they did, but the 7-Eleven stores were losing money as a chain. They were really going down the drain because people are scared to go to the stores and all the problems. And so the counselors from Joe went to the 7-Eleven store that they were having the most trouble with, and they said, look, you're off on a side street here. There's practically no lighting on this street. It's an excellent place for somebody to come in and out without being seen. You put advertisements on your windows, and you plaster the whole window square across with these advertisements so nobody on the outside can look in to see what's happening. You carry a cash load in your cash register that's just an obvious thing to come at late hours. You really load yourself up. Why wouldn't somebody come in and rip you off? Anyway, they went through a whole line, a list of things that they were doing, and they volunteered to take over one of their 7-Eleven stores and employ it, put all ex-offenders in there. And in the 6 months period that these ex-offenders run the program, they turned a profit. There was no problem at all. So this is just an example of what they did. They, in the process of talking to these people in the businesses, they tried to convince the employees to hire ex-offenders that it would be a good policy, in that most of these ex-offenders have moved from prison to prison, and they know the total population. They know who each other are. And if they are working in the front office or somewhere across the counter, and somebody walks in who's been just released and was just figuring on getting what he could out of the place, and he walks in and said, oh, Frank, I didn't know you were working here. And suddenly they say, well, since you're working here, I think I'll go someplace else. And they use this as an effort to convince people that hiring ex-offenders is good business. At the same time, I have to say that there are situations in which ex-offenders have gone on the job, and there are other agencies besides Job, too, that are placing ex-offenders on jobs, and it takes real courage by a businessman to hire ex-offenders, because if he gets one bad one, it may ruin his old attitude. And I talked to a manager of a bee company that makes products to handle hives, etc., and also processing the honey, and he's a Christian. He's had the courage to hire ex-offenders, and he's had good results from two or three, and he's had one which didn't work out very well, and they had to fire him. But at least he has the courage to keep trying with these people. I know of another person who hired an ex-offender in the Thousand Oaks area where I work, and he was hired as a mechanic, and he went on vacation. When he came back, he discovered that the mechanic had ruined all of his customers' cars, and that he was losing business left and right, and he had to let this guy go. So you have to make sure that the man knows what he's doing, and he's properly placed, or you can really end up with a bad situation. Another thing that Joe, too, has been doing is that they have been going to the high schools and junior highs, and part of a assembly hall open forum for all the students, they have put on a program to tell it like it is. So many times the juvenile problems in the schools, the youth have had an uncle or an aunt or a brother who has been in prison, and they come out and they really boast and brag about what great things that they've done in prison and how they've gotten along, and it's really a defense to protect themselves and their own ego. And these ex-offenders who've been through the system in Project Joe 2, they stand up and tell it like it really is and all the problems that they've had, and it's really a powerful program in letting these youth know what they can get into if they continue the route that they're going. And they really turned a lot of people around. As a result of these kinds of programs, this year the Pasadena school system has sort of demanded that they expand this program within their own school system. I think this sort of brings us up to date to most of what I said yesterday, except that I filled in a lot of my own discouragements and attempts and own ignorance. Let me just pick up with some of the things that I've been attempting to do to try to keep Project Joe 2 going with some ideas. One of these that I've just read about is called a Hood Samaritan. In the Boston area, there is a milk company called the Hood Milk Company, H-O-O-D. In the story that I'm going to tell you about, apparently one of their milkmen was out on a morning delivery, and he happened to spot some young man who was robbing two women at a house that he was delivering milk. And he jumped out of his milk car and ran in to the house to try to do something about it, and he apparently got into a struggle with the robber and was stabbed. In the meantime, while this was going on, the women were able to call the police, and the police got there and were able to catch this young man. The milkman was taken to the hospital and survived and was okay. But because of that, I think the city of Boston, I may have it wrong, established a award of valor for, it may have been the milk company that did this for this young man, for his efforts to save this. And the milk company then began to get interested in the problems of crime and to see what they could do about it. And they decided to set up what they called the Hood Samaritan. And what they did was they took one of their milk trucks and put a two-way radio in it. They equipped it with all of the necessities for on-the-spot road repair, tires, fan belts, a can of gasoline, emergency first aid equipment, all this kind of thing. And what they are doing is that they're taking ex-offenders who are within offenders who are within 6 months of their permanent release, and they are putting them in this truck, and his job is to drive around anywhere he wants to go, and if he spots anybody that needs help, he's to stop and help. And it may be somebody that's pulled over the side of the road that's run out of gas. He drops out and pours the gas. The guy wants to pay, says no, it's all for free, and he hands them a card as to who the company is that's doing it. It's good advertising at the same time. And it gives this man who is about to be released an opportunity to do good. He's working with the Straight Society, he's getting that preconditioning cultural shock over with, and he may come up to alongside of a grocery store and there's some lady struggling with a big cart of groceries trying to get in. He'll jump out and pick up, and this good Samaritan, Hood Samaritan, will pick up the groceries and put them in the cart for him and say, just wanted to help you out. And it gives an opportunity for an ex-offender to do good, you see, or an offender. And as near as I can tell from the program there and what it costs them, they figure about $20,000 a year to do this on a free basis and the kind of services that they're giving. But the effect on the offenders that are in this, it gets them contacts, it gets them into society in a way that they want to go straight, and they've got opportunities and they get training on the job while they're working, and eventually they're back into society. The other thing that I've been attempting to do is to write foundations or contact people in terms of see if we can get scholarships to support these people the first month or 2 months, to because that is just so critical. They need some help or on-the-job training if they have no skills, and so far I've been unsuccessful in finding any source of funds for that effort. I lost my notes here. Another thing that I'd like to do is to find some foundation or somebody who would donate a van bus in which Joe too could put all of their counseling equipment and records in there, and they could travel to where the ex-offender is, because many times these people don't have money to come to Joe too. the same time, I know Joe, too, is doing such a powerful job that ex-offenders from all over L.A. County and all over are just flocking into this place outside of Pasadena because they know the kind of help that they're getting there. So it's an effective program. Let me describe one more thing to you, and then I want to play a tape for you, and then we'll open it up for discussion. Last month, just before coming up here, I wrote a 7-page proposal to Governor Brown with copies to all of the senators and assemblymen in our state, trying to suggest a way to stop this cycle of increased crime. I think it's all right to work with ex-offenders, but if I don't catch them before they get to that point, we still haven't solved the problem. And as I look at my own children as they're coming up through the school system, and I have children ranging in age from 6 years old to 15, from kindergarten up through eighth grade. Not once in that period of their education have they ever been told anything about the correction system in California, what a prison is like, what the problems are in prison, what happens to a youth if he gets into trouble, what's the sequence of events. Almost inevitably, if a youth in school is getting into trouble, so long as the trouble isn't too bad, of course he's there, but if he is too disruptive, then the schools pull him out of there, and they have to, or else they could never get anything done. He gets sent to, and I've forgotten, what is the name of the school where they go to first? Does anybody remember the name of it? Anyway, there's a special school that they pull them out just for troublemakers. Well, whatever it turns out the name is. And my children never see these children anymore. It's no longer a problem, so they don't know the heartache that goes there. There's a whole series of steps that if he doesn't make it there, then the court may make him a ward. The parents can't handle him, he becomes a ward of the court. And then they may go to a detention area. In California, I think there are camps where they're pulled off and they're essentially in this camp and they have to work there and they go to school there. If they still cause problems, eventually there's a whole series of steps they may end up in what is essentially a kiddie prison. And the heartaches that these kids have, they come out after a day, they come back to a room which is locked. Their parents have disowned them, and they're just so lonely, and I just don't have time to develop all the things. But my children have no idea of what happens to youth, and they have no idea of what usually the parents do when they come up before the court. They're usually saying, they're not thinking in terms of the children. They're telling the judge, I don't know why Johnny ever behaved like this. They don't want to have anything to do with Johnny. It's his fault, not my fault, you see. And the poor kid just has no parental support in this situation. At any rate, I think my children should be exposed to what are the problems and what happens to a youth if he decides to go this route. And I work for the state myself as a teacher, and in that process, because I use state vehicles as a geologist to take my students out on field trips, I'm required to take a defensive driver training program, and the state brings a movie projector and two screens, and they have a program in which you simultaneously see three different screens. One which has motion pictures for action that's required, and two which project still shots when still are required, and they have some psychedelic music that goes along with it, and you see situations in which you are saying, now what would you do in this situation, and they give you a choice A, B, C, and you fill out, and then afterwards they tell you what the right answer is. It's a 3-hour program, and you really learn what goes on and how to protect yourself. And I just thought, gee, wouldn't it be neat if, I know it would be impossible for my children to ride on a prison bus down to a processing center and find out the degrading process that a prisoner goes through, I could just put that on a movie and watch the expressions on the faces, or watch what happens, and they could visualize this, and or still shots in a 3-hour program, and then have an ex-offender there who really knows what the situation is and can answer questions about it. Boy, that would have a tremendous effect in turning my children around. They're so used to hearing people, their peers, say, boasting about what they did when they ripped off or they're smoking marijuana, and there's a tremendous peer demand to be like them because they got away with something. But if they could see what happens to them if they get away with this and go to prison, I think there would be a tremendous effect. At the same time, I know that the people who are in the correction systems are doing all their effort to try to help these people, and they have a different viewpoint. And I think I ought to have in that 3-hour program somebody who is from the correction system, a guard or a judge or a lawyer who has to go to handle these people and get their viewpoint so my children can see both sides of the story. And I think in a 3-hour program like this that would go from school to school, I know the teachers aren't trained to handle this, but with something similar to this, you could get across to the children what are the problems of the correctional system, what it's costing them as a taxpayer, so that when they come through the schools, they'll be ready to vote for legislation to get rid of the prisons and to start helping to rehabilitate. Anyway, I've written up this proposal and sent it in the governor. I've not heard from Governor Brown. I think he's too busy, or has been too busy, trying to get elected to be nominated for the presidency. I've gotten some response from some of the senators and assemblymen that are interested, but they're waiting to see what the governor's going to do with it before they do anything. Let me just play for you, and it's getting late here, this tape by Chuck Colson, who you may remember is the hatchet man for President Nixon, who confessed to a crime and was sent to prison. Leo was kind enough to bring this tape, and on the tape is Senator, is it Hughes?
Yeah.
And Chuck Colson. Senator Hughes is a Democrat, of course Colson is a Republican, both of whom have turned their life over to Christ and have now come together to work as a team, the so-called odd couple. Chuck Colson has written a book, Born Again, and telling his experiences of conversion and his experience of going in prison. And just to cut things short here, I'm just going to play that portion of the tape where Chuck is telling you about his experiences of going into prison and what happened. And let me just pick up at that point.
Watergate in 2 cases, but really did I care that I was it important? And could I be free if I had to spend a couple of years trying to prove my innocence? And it didn't really matter much about the judgment of a court of law. What really counted to me was the judgment of Jesus Christ, and he'd already rendered it. And so we found something that I didn't believe I was guilty of what I was charged with, but I couldn't honestly go into court and say that I was, but I found something I had done that I thought was wrong, that ought to be a crime, and went to the prosecutors. And not to anyone's surprise, Mr. Jaworski briefly accepted my plea, and I pleaded guilty, no plea bargain, nothing noble about it, because there's nothing much noble that comes out of what the chapter of American history known as Watergate. It meant prison. People don't know how to bring that subject up nicely. You know, did you enjoy your time away? Did you have a nice trip? Well, it's pretty tough that first day when you stand in a bare wall receiving room and you're stripped naked and put into a shower and scrubbed down with hard soap, because most men coming into prison come from lice-infested county jails, overcrowded jails. And you're tossed a pair of undershorts, as I was, that had 5 number of stencils on them before each stricken out, you know, the 6th person putting them on. You go into a dormitory that night with 40 men that seem jam-packed in, and yet each one a million miles away from the other, because each one is racked with the same sort of loneliness, as if the world doesn't care, and of course it doesn't, separated from their families, feeling bitter, desperate, men who have some of them pretty tough tasks. My life was threatened the first week I was in prison, which didn't help my sleeping night. Pretty tough from a know, what happened in prison I shall never forget, and that's why I go back today wherever I can and try to encourage others who are behind bars, the 350,000 Americans who this night are in cold, dark concrete cells and jail holes all across this country. I met a young man the first night I was there. He had a cross, and I gathered he was a Christian, and I went up and I got kind of excited, and I said, you know, we ought to get a little group together here and start praying. And I really found out how marvelous fellowship can be in Washington with all those fellows I meet with up there. And he said, Uncle Chuck, he said, don't you carry that Bible around the compound. He said, you'll be laughed at. He said, don't you talk about religion down here. Nothing in this prison. Well, you know, most people think that it's like foxhole religion in the military, that when you're in prison, you reach out, you're in desperate shape, you need something in a hurry, so you grab hold of God. Well, it doesn't work that way. In prison, it's a society of men who prove themselves by their masculinity, and they're not about to let anyone think they need anything, least of all a Bible. So we began to pray, this one other man and myself, and somehow, miraculously, I think, and a week thereafter, we were in the library, and there was a man in prison, one of the 15% of the prison population who could neither read nor write, from the hills, no teeth in front. Terrible anguished look on his face, tears. In fact, he's coming up for parole the next day. The parole board was meeting at the prison. He wasn't technically eligible. He had 5 kids at home. His wife was sick. They lived on welfare and $190 a month in food stamps. And oh, how he wanted to be with his family. He wasn't one of those who had given up after a short while in prison. Just broke off their family relationships because they couldn't stand to live with the anxiety. He wanted to be back and to rebuild his life. And so we went over to him and said, can we pray with you, brother? Maybe we can help you. Maybe we'll just ask the Lord to intervene. So somehow, 7 of us soon found ourselves in a little room off the prison library in our dingy prison dungarees, down on our knees, 3 blacks, 4 whites, a couple of convicted narcotics peddlers. I probably put them there if they realized it. Parrot thief, a stock swindler, and a former special counsel to the President of the United States, praying that God would help this one man. And you know, a miracle happened. The next day, that man was paroled. And I want to tell you all that you could walk anywhere you wanted in that prison thereafter and carry this Bible around, and you wouldn't get a single person laughing at you. As a matter of fact, they'd line up at the door. We began to meet every night. They'd line up at the door to be there. They didn't know what was going on in that room, but if it meant a ticket getting out of prison, they were all for it. And that little fellowship grew to maybe a quarter of the prison population, which began attending Bible class. We began saying grace in the mess hall, and you could feel the power just move through that prison of men's lives being changed and the spirit of that prison being lifted from the terrible depths to which every prison falls. And I found out even there in prison that you can have freedom. The freedom is inside of you, and if it's in your relationship to Jesus Christ and God. And I saw men's lives change. And I correspond with those brothers whom I came to love as much as I love the brothers in Washington. I go back and visit them. I've been in 15 or 20 prisons since I left myself.
I think that's most of what has to do with prisons. It gives you a feeling from somebody who's been there, who's now out and trying to do something about it. He's written a book called Born Again, and the royalties from his book he's using to go back and help prisoners in the prison ministry. So, just in quick summary, the ex-offender program that I'm working with, its budget is about $171,000. On the average, they're placing about 275 clients a year with an average salary a little over $6,000. And the income of these 275 clients that has resulted from that has been about $1,700,000, and they're paying taxes out of that of about over $345,000. So they're paying back to the state and federal government taxes more than what the cost of the program is, in fact twice as much. And without the kind of program that they're doing, these people would be going back into prison, costing each of us probably $20,000 for each one going back. So that's the reason why I'm working with them, is to try to keep this kind of thing going, and the effect on the lives of these people and the increased safety for me, because they're not out trying to to rip me off or you off. I think it's really worthwhile. I'd like to stop at this point and just throw it open to you people, either for questions or comments or ideas that you might have that you think you could take back to your own congregations as to what can we do about the increasing crime rate, or how can you see where we can help an ex-offender, or the whole thing. And I'll just throw it open at this point.
There are halfway houses other than those you mentioned. Their program is much more limited, I guess.
There are halfway houses, but from what I understand, the halfway houses have a slightly different approach than what Joe 2 wants to do. And often the halfway houses are staffed by a minister or pastor or somebody like this who's from the Straight Society, and what they want to do is to put ex-offenders as counselors in these places. And I think it has merit there, because they talk the same language.
Well, it seems to me like a lot of the scars way back when the children are young, both not so much, not always in the home, but in the schools, when they took out the right and wrong, the morality issue. And it seems like what you're saying about the films and all this has to tie in with, which is something that maybe is coming back, but maybe isn't, I don't know. And I'm wondering if these people, these ex-offenders, are really saying that what they, that like robbery or any type of burglary, or the big word ripoff, sometimes is looked at as a real, in their minds, legal way to make a living, quote unquote. And we're looking at it as very wrong, because this is our standard of morality and ethics. This is our value system. And where do we all come together in understanding their value system? And why is it so different from mine, for instance? And I see this as I work in the schools, that there's this large gray area. It is not all black and all white.
As I've talked to some of these people, they're very realistic that they know that this wrong is wrong, but they feel like society has trapped them into conditions that they can't help doing this in order to survive. And it's like that 9 days, if you go 9 days without food, then any of us could be in that situation.
Don't you think that is one reason, is because they lack employment and they need something for their family, and the robbery is in our homes is just becoming more and more.
Sure.
And I think they think what they can take out and sell. You know, they're just, we're all feeling it.
I don't think there isn't one of them that hasn't been to prison who realizes that if we're going to get this kind of punishment, I don't want to go back in. And maybe it is necessary to convince these people in this situation this isn't the way to go. But when they do come out, then we really have got to spend the effort to rehabilitate and to reorientate, and spend most of our money in rehabilitation rather than warehousing. At least that's my viewpoint, and to provide these people with counseling and help. And there's where the money should be spent, I think.
It seems like yesterday when you were doing this last night, that you dealt a little more with really the sort of rejection of the program. I would call it a rejection of the program by the churches, and I guess by the community at large, on a personal level. And I think I was thinking of when you were talking about taking the program to the schools and having your children see, first of all, how awful what will happen to them is. But also maybe to see, as you experience, that these are just people like them, and that what is necessary, one of the things that's necessary for the ex-offenders is support and acceptance of them. If they're going to be rejected by the community, there's really no point in there. Why should they? They've already been rejected by family, in many cases. Why should they not go rip off?
Yeah.
Again,
it's
one way they
it's
know
one of the things that I'm. I think I've really tossed out a very controversial thing to the senators' state assembly, because I can just picture some irate housewife. What do you mean? You're going to bring ex-offenders to school? You're going to, they're going to teach my kids how to really rip off and get away with it. And there's this hysteria, paranoia of what an ex-offender is, and to try to educate people that they're just like us and want to go straight if they just get the chance. So I don't know what I'm getting up against, but I'm convinced that probably 80-85% of them really want to go straight if they just had the chance.
Mm.
Larry? Yes.
I was wondering, from your description last night of your contact with the churches, whether you can really wipe them out or wash them off the way you did. I wonder whether you have really tried to work with them the way that you suggested with the schools. For instance, it seemed to me you said that there was no church interest, and so you took off from work at half the day. And you went around and you went to this church and that church, and you encountered one pastor who said he had to make a hospital call. Okay, this seems a very, very shallow criticism or something, but I thought perhaps you should have made an appointment. I don't think you can say that church was not interested because a man was going someplace and you walked in the door.
Yeah. There wasn't. I need to explain myself again. I think you made a very good point. I don't think I have been fair to that minister. I should have made an appointment. I just shouldn't have showed up, and I intend to go back and make an appointment with this particular minister and do it right. It was my fault, not his. And I'm not writing off the churches. My problem is that I've had to travel 60 miles, it's an hour either way, and to do all the things that I'm doing. And I think it's wrong to say the churches haven't done anything, and particularly to say the ministers haven't done anything. They're so overloaded and so busy, they don't have the time to take on everything. And really, the churches are you and I, and what I hope to do is to talk to the minister and saying, would you be willing to invite out Joe too to give a presentation? And I know that the churches, I know my own church is overloaded in their budget. We're not even meeting all of our expenses, but I'm not going around to a church and say, would you contribute such and such to this program? They can't even meet their own budget. But I hope, because of that, to get somebody in that congregation, maybe somebody like myself, and say, gee, this is a problem that needs to be done. I'd like to help, and they'll give something over and beyond, and they become the church in that situation, and they get excited about it and come join me and help me work my way out of my job so that somebody in the Pasadena area can start getting behind these people. And I did give the wrong impression yesterday, and I'm not really discouraged about the churches. I think there's a tremendous potential there. It just needs, the ex-offenders have gone to talk to the council of ministers in that area. They've gotten one church interested, and they have pledged $2,500 to help them. That's only one church, and I think that they're all 30 or 40 or 50 of them ought to have somebody from each of the churches involved. And I guess it's going to be up to me to go around and be that person who is not an ex-offender, to get people excited to realize that they can invite an ex-offender in and it isn't going to hurt them any. But I'm not discouraged about the churches.
Is there any way that films and literature could be compiled, that could be sent to churches and that we could use with our Luther leagues and young people? Is there any way, or that takes money, I realize that. But I mean, it seems like if we couldn't have people come to talk, if there would be some way, because I can see this being a very vital thing with our Luther League groups.
I could see it too, but to my knowledge, there's absolutely no film that portrays what I want to do.
I see.
Nobody's done it. I mean, this is a vast, untapped area. As I've gone through a volume that thick of foundations of what kinds of things that people have given money for to support, there's no category within the vast index of all these foundations of what they'll support that includes ex-offenders. I'll take that back. There was one foundation who the man gave some money to ex-offenders to get them going, but there's only one, and he's been so swamped that I couldn't get any more money out of him on that.
It seems also to me, again, personal sort of thing is more important.
Oh, yes.
I mean, as long as you're talking about something which happens more or less in a county or at least in a state, and you're traveling miles and miles all the time anyway, I think we're sort of, you know, overloaded by TV and movie presentations, that it's still
always
something.
If not,
like a wiser use of your resources to me to send people around and film.
I've not seen the TV program that's on that has something to do with prison life, but somebody has described it.
Oh, yeah, I didn't mean that there's a lot of films about prison life.
Right.
Just problems in general,
yeah.
You know, little spot commercials on TV for Hope or Care, or any of these things.
There are four things I want to say. The first one, relative to your statistics on maybe 300% increase in. It's probably worse than that, because a lot of crimes are not reported. A very large number of them are not reported. Number two, I certainly commend you in your work in this regard. And you realize, as a lot of people have not realized, the truth of the Indian proverb that says, unless you walk 2 miles from a fellow's moccasin, you can't really relate to him. And why? What's the most successful alcoholic or control program today? It's run by the alcoholic himself. The same token here, Larry realizes this, and sooner we realize that the person who knows the situation and experiences it is the one that can help. The third thing I want to relate to you is the loneliness that does exist in prisons and in the whole system, and I can best do this in a sort of a personal thing. Our son is an internist, and he spends a lot of his holidays and weekends on 24-hour duty in a state prison in North Carolina, where you really have some remarkable people, and as you say, some of them are downright dangerous in society. Many of them are not. One fellow I'll tell you about who was very disturbed. My son was very disturbed because of him. His name, we call him Joseph Harris. He was black. One day, he was a very likable fellow, late 30s, and one day he got in a big tiff with his girlfriend, and she got wheeled off at him and threw a hot live on his face, and put out one eye, and then he blew from the side of the other. And in a bit of anger following this incident, he killed her and several of her friends. And he's in prison, and I suppose he has some. They're waiting anxiously, hoping that they'll get the death penalty so they can polish Joel's hair off. And he has, I suppose, five life terms consecutive. Now, our son's evaluation is this fellow is. Not a hazard, really. I mean, in spite of this, you know. But here's a guy, there's nothing for him. There's absolutely nothing. No hope at all. So he saved up. The psychiatrists were in and decided he's depressed, which is understandable. I could have made that diagnosis from this distance. But, and I'm a veterinarian. But they started giving him tranquilizer as well. Well, first, before this, he tried to starve himself. He realized that they wouldn't let him die because they wanted to kill him when the chance came. And again, they started intravenous therapy. So he saved up his tranquilizer 5 days, took the whole load, and that didn't do much for him. So at Christmas, he stayed it up for 21 days, took the whole load, and our son happened to be on duty. And they asked him, then, you got to save Joel Harris's life. And that's a pretty hard, that's laying it on pretty heavy, you know. And he asked me why. It's an interesting question. I am reminded of the charge in Matthew 25. And if I read it the way I read it, you know, Jesus says, I was in prison and you visited me. No. He didn't say that he wasn't there for unjust reasons. He He's not saying that. He is saying he's in prison maybe for a just reason. And that's laying it on pretty heavy on us. And I'm not sure that Joe Louis Harris isn't Jesus in that regard. Those people that are there, to us, I think Matthew 25 says, that's Jesus there. Those are the four things I wanted to say.
I just say one sentence at the end of that. I spent a night once in a woman's penitentiary in St. Louis, outside of St. Louis, with a professor's wife from the cemetery. From the cemetery, who was doing a great deal of work with women ex-offenders, and she came and she said to the fellows at the seminary, you know, Christ didn't die on an altar between two candles.
That's beautiful. I think one point that I would like to make with you, the prisoners or ex-offenders that I've met, I had always pictured as being somewhere in the lower part of society, but I've met teachers, some very professional people, and just one slip up, they got in trouble and they're in prison. So you find them from all levels, all the way up to Chuck Colson.
Yeah, including the veterinarian.
So
you get a lot of professional help. McNeil Island, they have professional help.
Any other comments? Or I know it's getting about time for a coffee break, if we have coffee break on Saturday.
I have a very sad experience in my life in relation to someone doing this. I guess I'm sitting here, two of them in the last past year, where a shooting has caused much sorrow. But this happened to be just a 17-year-old black boy, and it involves my son-in-law. And I had gone to Georgia, very happy on vacation this time of the year. He ran the apartment complex. This boy was living in someone else's home that he had got in that had gone away, and he comes in and demands, I want money back. I'm going. And Steve said to him, well, that isn't your money. And he said, well, you either give it to me or I'll shoot you. And he pulls out the revolver, you know. Steve says, well, you have to be kidding. He said, I know you have a safe back then. With that, he fires. And he ducks the first time, but then the manager hears and comes. But of course, by a thread of life, it went through. We went through a period that he lives, and even he are very happy, and I think God has answered our prayers. But the point was, even Steve thought we have to pray for this boy. He's only 17. And he had no way to go. He needed a path. Finally, they couldn't find him. And of course, he said, I'll be back to get you. And of course, we live all in fear of when he would come back. And of course, finally he came back to his mother and they did capture him and the trial came up. And because he was only 17 and the fact that Steve lived, they put him in what we have in Ohio called the Ohio Youth Commission. And we're hoping that he can come back in society. That's our prayers, because we have. But I mean, these are things that happen at Christmas time or the month after my daughter's husband's brother, who had been through three battles and scenes of war and came back, and I had known he and his Ingrid, his German bride of 2 years, and they had a little girl born too. They were shopping near Fort Knox, and this black woman comes up to them and says, you have my children. And Ingrid turns and says, you have to be kidding. And with that, why, she went on, come back, and then she said, I say, give me my two children. And she fires a gun, and he kills him immediately in front of little Kathy's feet, you know. And Ingrid said, someone get that man, or get that woman. Well, they've gotten her, and the end of the course is that she was from an insane asylum and was on leave. Very high respected Christian woman, and now she's begging in the court trial, I didn't mean it, I didn't want to do it, and begs for a chance to to come back into society. Well, she's been put in for 20 years. But on good behavior, we hope she can come out again. Who knows but one of us this could happen. But it's these tragedies that it happens that it causes. And you, that's why I think we must do something. I just had to share.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Larry, have you done any have you looked into relationship between the criminals or the ex offenders and mental institutions, and what kind, are there rehabilitation programs that includes psychiatric things, and what kind of rate of
see, I don't know.
Back into society, do they have?
I know that there are prison psychologists and this sort of program, but I don't know to what extent they're working in the mental aspect of it all. I just don't know the answer. Well, I guess it's time to take a break and go get some coffee or something. Thank you for coming, Liz.